Welcome to the weekly, where heroes don't do that.
Oh, right. Okay, so we're doing that. Okay.
I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris. And apparently, that's what we're talking about now.
Well, we may not. I just wanted to reference that. For John brought that up. I thought that was a good thing to remember.
John actually called me out on a response I had to, because did you just see, like a couple hours ago, Zack Snyder posted up like a picture, like an illustration of that. And I'm just like, yeah, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Batman like dropped a contact.
Right.
And Selina Kyle like carefully positioned her legs. And then, to John's credit, I did move the goalposts. Mm-hmm. Because then I said, even if he does, like, he's probably real sucky at it. Because the expression the artist drew Catwoman with is just like, that's boredom. That is straight up boredom.
Yeah. I think the cowl would get in the way, too. I don't know.
Anyhow.
Well, to figure out what we're talking about, I guess you'll have to head
just
to Twitter.
Yeah.
But this week, we're going to discuss the original Twilight 2000 is on DriveThruRPG.
Cool.
And I think that's kind of in time with the Free League release of the new version.
Cool.
Warhammer World mentions 3D printing in their new restrictions for events and a Lord of the Rings anime.
Hmm.
So we'll see
what
that's all about. So, the original version of Twilight 2000 is now on sale on DriveThruRPG as part of their post-apocalyptic sale.
Right,
that might be ending soon, but that was announced just recently. And So it was originally published in 1984 and set after the Twilight War. So the setting, so if you don't know Twilight 2000, NATO and the United States battle the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact in a lengthy, brutal, conventional war until things went nuclear. So the game is typically set in Central Europe, and in this version, it's a completely new scan of the reprint edition and includes the four Poland adventures and the core rules.
Cool. So this is a scan of the old thing.
Right. So it's digitally available. I'm not sure if they're going to do print on demand, but this is, I think there's probably been like illegal scans or, you know, different versions floating around. Mm. And this is the first time a scan of like a PDF version on DriveThruRPG.
Okay.
And so this is, I think, in time, the timing is, so you can see the original rule set and everything and kind of, you know, give a comparison to the fourth edition, which was kickstarted by Free League Publishing.
I did not realize that the Free League version of Twilight 2000 was the fourth edition.
Yeah, they've gone through.
I thought it was like the second.
No, yeah. They've gone through a few, and there have been, a lot of permutations and a lot of, fan-contributed stuff. Yeah, it's a very active community. So the thing about the first edition that they talk about is it introduced the rules, so one general resolution system for all types of combat.
Okay.
So that would mean hand-to-hand or firing on a vehicle or anything. And so there were separate chart booklets that you would, two-page spreads that you would refer to that would, have tables. So about, kind of back, and this is the 80s, role-playing, so back in the day. And so things got kind of granular, and, people talk about, you're counting bullets, and it's got more of a survival mechanic that has then been adapted and used in more recent Free League games. So, like Forbidden Lands has a kind of a hex-crawling, it's an abstracted kind of supply and survival mechanic, but this was kind of the original, I think, inspiration.
Yeah, well,
for that.
Sorry. Yeah, we talked about a lot. Playing Alien RPG,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure I borrowed something like that from Free League, where you have like air, water, power,
and
the things like that. And it's just kind of like an abstracted dice pool or die pool that slowly ticks down.
Mm-hmm.
And I've not looked at the Twilight 2000, the original rule set.
Mm-hmm.
I have looked at a version of it, because I've mentioned before, for some reason, the official Cadillacs and Dinosaurs, a.k.a. the Xenozoic Tales RPG, used the Twilight 2000 system.
That's right.
Not sure why.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a product of the 80s, but looking at it and reading that, and I'm like, you're driving around in souped-up cars that run off fucking dinosaur guano while you're trying to like outrun dinosaurs. Why do we have a rule set where counting bullets is important? Because that's what it was. Like,
you
had all these tables and charts and, like, all the weapons talking about, like, ammo capacity and all this stuff. But if you're going to do, like, post-apocalyptic survival stuff,
mm-hmm.
It's the 80s, so I understand why you would have to meticulously calculate what you are carrying. Right. And that's, I am imagining that's where the drama of the game largely comes from for Twilight 2000 is counting bullets and or not knowing when you're going to be able to resupply and do all this stuff again, hence kind of the post-apocalyptic or because due to the post-apocalyptic stuff, right? So that those kind of tense situations of should we use this, should we not, we don't know when we're going to resupply, yada yada yada. Great for post-apocalypse survival. Not so much for pulp car action dinosaur.
It's interesting that they didn't, but I guess if you think about it at that time, if you're not going to go with a complicated system, either something similar to Dungeons and Dragons, maybe you won't be taken seriously. Mm. So, you know, maybe they wanted to target a more serious RPG crowd, and that's why they chose that system. Yeah, because there were lighter systems. There were lighter D6 systems and, like, Fighting Fantasy, and there's all kinds of things that they could have gone with, like, a two-stat system. But, maybe it was. And it's probably licensing and those things
probably.
As well.
Like, or maybe they said there's already rules for vehicles and cars.
Right.
Or, those are the same thing. Vehicles and guns and stuff like that, which are part of the Xenozoic Tales. Let's use this.
Right. So. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah, that's a fun property I think that it's been reprinted a few times, but those original comics. But
I kickstarted the complete volume.
Oh, nice.
So it's coming because I still have designs on running that game.
Oh, nice. Oh,
not cool. The officially licensed game. Anyway.
Excellent. Well, another update, and this kind of ties into what we talked about last week, and that's kind of what's on the table. I got an email from Eclipse, the makers of Eclipse Phase. So Subhuman
Studio.
They were subhuman. They're posthuman. Sorry, Posthuman Studios. So they noticed this and gave a notification to anybody interested, and said they're going to lower the price of all of their premium color print on demand books, and in some cases it's going to be exactly the same as the standard color prints. So in anticipation for this dramatic price hike. So Posthuman said the books that are going to be on sale are Eclipse Phase second edition soft cover, the first edition both soft and hardcover, and then Sunward, Panopticon, Transhuman, the Morph Recognition Guide, A Time of Eclipse, and everything is already pre-adjusted, so there's no coupon or code or anything. So if you're interested in any of picking up physical copies of any of those games in the nicer version at the best price you're going to get for a while, this would be your chance. So just search Posthuman or Eclipse Phase on DriveThruRPG, and you'll find everything they've got to offer.
Yeah, again, I've said before, keep rehashing myself. Eclipse Phase has one of the most interesting, like, post or transhuman sci-fi settings.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't that keen on the system. It was a little bit too fiddly for me. Like, I remember back when we ran a game, like, body hopping is supposed to be this big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Chris had to make, like, an automated Excel spreadsheet to calculate all your new stats and everything when you... And it's something you can't do during a session, which kind of defeats the purpose. I mean, like, if the whole point is, like, we're going to travel to Jupiter, we don't have to physically travel there. We just, like, beam our consciousness and then
into a
body turn in next session, and that's only going to be character creation again.
Right.
Oh, we're going somewhere else now. Yeah.
Yeah, so just like a series of session zeros, basically, to get your character up and running. Yeah, interesting.
Really cool ideas. Mm-hmm. So I recommend picking it up for the setting. I do it in something else.
Yeah, have you taken a look at second edition? I wonder if they've addressed any of that.
But I wonder what the difference is.
I'm curious about that too. And they still keep first edition in print, so there may be some people that maybe they made changes in second edition. People are just like, no, we love recalculating our strength bonuses.
That's what we're doing, yeah.
All right, so Warhammer World posted, and this has been around since 2019, but because there hasn't been any events since late 2019, people are starting to notice. They made a specific reference to 3D printed conversions and parts on miniatures. Yeah, so they did a whole kind of FAQ and getting really strict about paint schemes and everything. Like the miniatures have to be equipped with the weapons that you're using. They have to be, visually distinct if they're separate battalions, and they have to be of the chapter. You can't kind of proxy chapters. You can't play salamanders as ultramarines or anything, because there are now such differences in the access, the abilities that they have access to.
I'll probably never go to a tournament again. Right. I remember staying up all night with my brother in high school as we desperately tried to make sure there were three colors
on his
Cadian Imperial Guard back when there weren't plastic kits. Yes. And then showing up and seeing people with like a half-finished rhino on the table, like never again.
Right.
Anyway, I think those rules have kind of always been in place.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually don't disagree with those, mm-hmm. right? For tournaments, what you see is what you get. And like plasma weapons look different from flamers, look different from bolters. Right, so make sure the model has what they actually have. I understand wanting to have battalions or squads being distinct, mm-hmm. because especially if you like pile them in together, who's what? They're armed with what and okay, yep. Salamanders are different from Ultramarines. So if you're going to play salamanders, make them look like salamanders.
Right.
You know. So those I don't disagree with.
Yeah. So they're kind of, but a little bit stricter rules about painting. So it's, you know, going to involve a lot more work. You can't come half-assed or can't come like, you know, everything's based blue.
Yeah. Well, you could base everything blue if you're playing Ultramarines, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So just base your stuff green if you're going to play Salamanders. Yeah.
But the one question on the FAQ that stood out is, are 3D printed parts I've designed allowed?
Okay.
And they said, much like hand sculpted details, like in green stuff, mm-hmm. If you've gone to the effort of designing and printing your own bespoke parts for your army, then these parts are indeed permitted at our events. Commercially available, third party 3D printed parts aren't permitted, though. So bear in mind, if you do spot cast printed parts on your miniatures at the events, we may ask you to prove where you got them from. And we may ask you to remove them if we have doubts of their origins.
I don't know how they're going to enforce that.
I know. And they don't quite understand how 3D, like most people, if they're going to, like if they're not a professional 3D mm-hmm. artist, they're going to find a thing to sculpt. They're going to find an existing 3D model, which is probably commercially available. It may be free, but it's still like, you know, allowing commercial use, or you're going to be modifying a 3D model. So proving the origin of that is going to be very strange. And most of it will come from some pre-existing source, probably produced professionally.
So it's interesting because the beginning part, right, much like hand sculpted stuff, right? And yeah, back in the day, I would sculpt green, not super professionally, but sculpt green stuff like purity seals or whatever, or anything. That part I get because you've done it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand the connection with GW saying, great, if you modeled this thing yourself, it's the same thing. But what I'm thinking of is like when you go to eBay and you find like those prior to 3D printing, mm-hmm. you would have to buy like the packs of the special shoulder plates for the chapters that GW didn't make mm-hmm. insignias for. Where did those fall?
Yeah,
because like if they were allowing those, the owner of the army didn't sculpt those.
Right.
So how is that different from purchasing 3D models made by someone else to put on your thing?
Yeah, you know? It's getting a little confusing because they are specific, not talking about 3D printing. They are talking about other custom commercially available, like head swaps and things are not allowed.
Yeah.
So it has to be, so the rule used to be 90%. So every model should be 90% Games Workshop. Hmm. So it limited conversions, head swaps, pauldrons and things. But the stuff goes in and out of production with them so often. Then there's older stuff that you're kind of scavenging. So how is it different, like scavenging something on eBay that they're not profiting from in any way because it's being who knows how many times it's been resold? Or, you know, people doing like the kind of press synthetic clay, like for insignias and stuff. It's getting a little murky and they don't quite understand what they're stepping into. And of course, they're going to try to hold on to this. So getting more strict at their events is a sign that they're going to hold on to this, producing these physical miniatures as long as possible. Well, and there's not going to be any step into 3D or allowing people like, you know, selling digital anything.
Well, I absolutely understand them wanting to hold on to that for as long as possible. And maybe it was off the cast last week or a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about GW might be smart to start releasing official STL files.
Right.
Like, great. We know this is going to happen. Get it from us.
Yeah, right.
Right? Mm-hmm. We're at least going to get paid for this. Because as a company, I understand they want to make money. So I understand the 90% conversion thing. Like the bulk of this has to come from us. And I guess in the case of like eBay and stuff, someone did get it from GW So GW did get money from it, regardless of how many times it's been resold.
Yeah, yeah.
But I really just, I have no idea how they are going to enforce
the origin of a
3D printed thing. Like, what are they going to do? Have a catalog of like every 28 millimeter 3D printed part to compare against?
Yeah, right, right.
Or are they just going to, I mean, you could look at something and go, okay, that's not GW. Or 90%, more than 90% of that. No, the other way. Less than 90% of that is a GW Mini.
Right, right.
You can, therefore, you can't use it. They're not going to be able to look at something and say,
right,
because maybe the person actually did sculpt it themselves. Right? That's the even trickier part.
Yeah, yeah. It's impossible to. So yeah, if you can't find it on the internet, then maybe they sculpted it.
Yeah, exactly. Or even if you find something that's real similar. Right. Anyway, yeah, I don't see how they're going to force that.
And my argument against like third party heads and pauldrons and stuff is, if they made more attractive female heads, people wouldn't be buying those.
Well, you got the new, I'm sure you got the new Sisters of Battle in there.
They're pretty rough, and the Drakari are pretty rough. Yeah, yeah, they're not going out of their way to pretty up any of those lines.
Well, this is a completely different line. Rough as in poorly sculpted.
Yeah, just as
or yeah. Rough as in not conventional by, or not attractive by conventional standards.
It's just rough. I won't go into it anymore. But yeah, it's just, I mean, that market wouldn't exist if people were like, oh, you know, people weren't kind of cringing. And they're moving away from, like, they have metal and fine cast that look okay, and then things start getting really angular and yeah, very strange, yeah. But yeah, that's personal opinion, of course. Yeah, yeah. So that's a weird thing, and so they're aware of it. They're paying attention to it, and who knows like what that's going to mean. And when you look at like we've been dealing with the War Master, you know, directly supporting artists that are doing these like 10 millimeter sculpts,
which is tiny as right. After cutting all the some of the supports off, and I'm like, oh my god, these are small. Right.
But the thing that's they're going to have to deal with is the artists that do that. They can make a pretty decent living. Mm-hmm. You know, with a Patreon and doing that and going directly to customers, how are they going to keep the best sculptors and people working on GW products and not leaving and going to do that if they're, you know, I don't know what these sculptors make, but it's not what some of these Patreons are pulling in every month. So, but yeah.
That's a good point. I guess the only, again, I don't know what it's like to be a sculptor for GW or a professional miniature sculptor. Maybe you get enough like benefits and a steady income where Patreon and things like that are not, right? Like you're not pulling in health insurance from a Patreon.
Yeah,
and it's going to depend on, well, I couldn't really produce anything this month,
kind of
thing. Whereas GW might be steady. I don't know. I mean, never worked for them, so I can't. Sorry, never worked for them in that capacity, so I can't say. But yeah, but that is something as a miniatures company. GW and probably to a lesser extent Privateer Press should kind of be taken note of and wondering, we're putting stuff in motion now about what to do to stay kind of in business.
Yeah, yeah, because it's, I mean, they're going to be down to just producing rule sets, and if they've already decided like to give away basic free rule sets, then yeah, it's gonna get difficult. And
like we were talking last week, the rise of miniatures agnostic rule sets. I mean, it's name recognition, GW and you know, Privateer Press. So it's not as if they switched to only rule sets. They'd probably still do okay. But you take away the miniatures, and I think you're increasing your own competition with the amount of miniatures agnostic or other rule sets that are already out there and have fan bases.
Yeah, and yeah, that people love. Yeah, that they're not going to switch away from. Yeah, so it'll be we're going to have some odd times when there's going to be these adjustments, because you know probably the expense that they have of keeping so far ahead of everybody else in the quality of production and scale that they're doing. They're it's going to come to the point where like, oh, maybe this is we can't do this anymore because of how splintered. But it's still, if they stay as expensive as they are, they're going to eat up everybody's hobby budget that plays, you know, any sort of Warhammer game. So no one's going to look at any of these other rule sets because they can't afford, you know, to even buy a book. Everything is all sunk into that GW monster. Well, speaking of monsters,
we are
looking at a Lord of the Rings anime that's in production that is going to be produced by New Line. Okay. And so I guess is that Warner Brothers? I think ultimately I think that's ultimately Warner Brothers. So I'm anticipating the look of this. I don't know. I mean, it has a Japanese director, right, but okay. When I think of this, you know, anime that's produced by Western properties, a lot of times I think of how they did the DC Heroes, those kind of animated shorts of DC Comics.
Okay.
And so it's kind of a Korean anime style. It's a kind of a, you know, a hybrid style. But this does have a Japanese director, so I'm curious what that's going to mean. So the franchise is headed to the big screen. They're releasing this theatrically. I mean, if there is such a thing. Warner Animation title. Wow. So similar to the DC. Yeah, it's going to be similar to in the quality of the DC movies that they've done, like kind of direct to video.
Oh, I haven't seen any of those. You're talking about like Batman: Mask of the Phantasm.
Yeah, right. Like yeah, they've done like Killing Joke, and they've done almost all the major event comics for the kind of DC universe as animation.
Okay.
And they're decent, but they're very kind of hybrid Asian studio. So none of the original writers. So this is going to be kind of the
Lord of the Rings. Yeah, I should think not.
No, the movies. Yeah.
Oh, right.
So
okay.
it's set, and the style is going to be of the Peter Jackson New Line movies, but none of the original writers or producers are going to be involved. So we'll see what that's actually going to mean for the quality. So the title of this will be The War of the Rohirrim. So focused on Rohan and so the king of Rohan at the time of this setting is Helm Hammerhand, and they're going to do the legendary battle. So kind of like a large scale, which is a good idea for animation. So expand on that untold story of the behind the fortress of
Helm's Deep.
Yeah, Helm's Deep. Yeah. So we'll find out some of that backstory, maybe kind of the fall of the when they started to encounter their troubles, the horse riders' troubles, and their king kind of fell. So yeah, so that's going to be the centerpiece of the animation, and not any relation. So this is of course going to be set during the Third Age, but 250 years before the movie. And the Amazon series is set in the Second Age, so it's even
I had forgotten there was an Amazon. So the Amazon is live action, isn't it?
Yes, it definitely is.
Well, it kind of was ish already. It looks like Lord of the Rings is turning into like another massive franchise kind of thing, and I guess that's seems to be the way media companies want to make money, is they want like a franchise to keep spinning stuff off of. I can't blame them. I mean, if the stuff's already kind of quasi written, it's a lot easier to do. But anyway, if you are going to do, it's not an origin story, but if you are going to do something new, it's got to be kind of before. And it's been referenced. We kind of know the end result, but we don't have any details.
Yeah.
So you can kind of do whatever you want with it. So.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And the Japanese director is Kenji Kamiyama. He was responsible for that, prequel to Blade Runner 2049, but the anime that took place between the two Blade Runner movies.
I wasn't aware.
Yeah, so Blade Runner Black Lotus.
Is it just as misogynistic as 2049?
It's very anime, yeah. And
not selling it for me.
And he worked on also the TV series, the Ghost in the Shell standalone complex, which was that was really well written and well produced. But it is going to be anime. And I don't know, hopefully the production, they can... If it's going to be a theatrical release or just like a premium direct-to-video, it'll hopefully look better than some of the TV stuff. But we'll see. Yeah, and the there's a lot of the same kind of production staff that have worked on other animation for Warner Brothers and New Line, but nobody that's like the star. Okay. So we'll see. So they've done properties like this before. Yeah, the Blade Runner anime was very anime. It was like it didn't quite feel in universe, but they wanted to tell the story of the destruction of that data center or whatever when everyone's records were expunged because there was a huge
blackout.
The blackout, right. So so we'll see. And I guess, you know, that since they still have rights to this property, I mean, the Lord of the Rings movies grossed almost $6 billion. So wow. I think they want to hold on and keep this property alive and not let Amazon take advantage of all the good all the fan base that they produced. So I don't know. Yeah, I'm kind of cautiously optimistic. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing what this looks like more than that Amazon series. The Amazon series already sounds like disaster. I don't know what they're gonna what they're thinking, but so we have that, and they didn't
give any kind of
not a release date or anything yet, but upcoming.
Well,
and I guess it depends on the state of theaters and everything else, and I'm not sure who they're associated with streaming, if that's like Hulu, Netflix, or who where that's going to eventually end up, because of course we don't buy physical media anymore.
No, we don't.
We just wait for things to pop up for free on one of our many subscription services. Well, for free.
I'm mildly curious.
It's a good, but I think it's a good, like a smaller good. They made a good choice, I think, of story, and I think that could look really good in animation. But I don't know.
Yeah,
we'll hold our judgment. But I just thought that was an odd idea, like an anime produced Lord of the Rings, because you would think of, based on all the illustrations. I mean, I don't really see a lot. I guess for the maybe books or comics or whatever they've produced in Japan, there is anime style Frodo and whatever. there must be.
Based on the covers, the couple covers, I think it was three, I saw of A Song of Ice and Fire.
Oh, yeah.
Here. I mean, like, I'm sure they're alternates. I have pictures somewhere where I'm like, really? Really? Like,
yeah.
What's this, like, Song of Ice and Fire shoujo manga edition?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, but it's weird where books here are a specific size. And so, like, Song of Ice and Fire book one was, like, three of those little books because...
Yeah,
you got I kind of like them because they fit right in your pocket rather than having
very
this
pocket
massive tome of like Dune or whatever. But I wonder how many books that would get broken into here. But anyway, you're right. Back on topic, there probably is an anime version Lord of the Rings here somewhere in Japan. I wonder if this is just kind of because anime has always kind of been popular, but is now. Hate to say become more mainstream, but like with successes of things like, Avatar and like Legend of Korra and a couple of the other ones that are a bit more anime-ish, major corporations are going, hey, let's make this too.
Yeah, I don't think there really isn't an American animated style anymore. I mean, so everything is produced in Korean studios or whatever, kind of like those weird piecemeal studios where everyone's taking a scene.
You have that untrue Cal Art style that we were discussing.
Oh, right. Yes. So I guess the TV anime. Yeah, what's that?
I'll disagree with you. There is an American style. It's the god-awful. Family Guy / adult cartoon thing where you look at and you're less
Oh, that's right. Because they've done original stuff that's not done by that studio that looks like Family Guy or that's right. I've seen some of those original.
It's that or the Star Trek thing, Lower Decks, where you're just looking and just like
that has the Family Guy vibe too, the character design. Yeah. That's true. I guess that is the American animation style.
Ask us how we feel about it.
Yeah, so, that's right. But, because Warner Brothers, I think, already had this for producing the DC Comics stuff, I think that they're going to give this a shot.
Oh, true, yeah.
But, I hope they put some money into it. And I hope they use the kind of the digital animation to give us some, like, hand-drawn or hand-painted looking things so that it feels more like Middle Earth and not... just
CG Earth.
Yeah, just Korea or whatever, futuristic Korea. Yeah, so we'll see how that goes. All right. So where can people find you?
On Twitter, as always, where I'm still continuing that massive card-based board game thread.
Excellent.
I've lost count of how many tweets it is now, but it's HiveMind, HYVEMYND, interspersed with rants about work and raising a kid.
Oh, nice.
How about you?
Excellent. So I do a single panel gag cartoon that I live stream the drawing of every week. So if you look for Abuse Cartoons on either Twitch or YouTube, you can find that. And that happens Monday night, North American time, kind of Tuesday afternoon-ish if you're in Asia, Australia kind of time zone. And Twitter is Abuse Cartoons, and the archive of all those cartoons, if you want to see what it's all about, is gocomics.com/domesticabuse. And if you would like to support the weekly and see more things happening and less green video, please consider going to patreon.com/upturntable. And of course, everything we do, you can find on Upturntable. So the reviews, unboxings, and the weekly, and also an audio version of this is released on all the podcast platforms. So wherever you listen to podcasts, you can also hear the audio version of this. So just search for Upturntable or the weekly and...
yeah,
you'll have it. All right, so that's it for this week.
Awesome.
We'll be back next week.
Later, mortals.
Goodbye.